All right, those are the five. Now, as you age, neurons are going to go from undifferentiated to differentiated to dead. So a undifferentiated one are like stem cells. The cells in your nose are undifferentiated. They're always undifferentiated. You could take a nose cell and do all kinds of stuff with it. Now, the reason that you have to have undifferentiated cells in your nose is because periodically you have to make new olfactory cells about every 2 weeks. You have to have new taste buds. You have to have new smell ones. So they have to have some places for these things to just be undifferentiated. To become differentiated, to find the spot that they're going, you use pathfinding. This is where the chemical pathfinding. This is back in the 1920s. There's a guy by the name of Weiss who took a salamander and attached another leg to the salamander. So it had an extra one. And eventually that legs began to sync with all the other legs of the salamander, showing that the synapses grew together and they incorporated it along the way. So the theory here is that neurons attach to muscles randomly, that a variety of messages are sent out, and then each one is tuned to a particular muscle when it works. This is what they hope happens when they, an amputee, and they put either prosthesis or if they transfer, you know, give you a new hand, that when they transplant something, they're hoping that all of the little ones will connect together. But they're, all the neurons are still firing, right? It has to be alive, the finger, the hand, whatever you're transplanting, has to be alive, so all the neurons have to fire. And they are firing, and then the neurons on the other side are firing, and when they connect, they're hoping that they'll make a connection, rather randomly, but a connection. And it doesn't matter who they connect with. Like, take a thousand on one side and 1,000 on the other. They were all numbered, you know, 1 through 1,000, and they all, originally. Now number 1 will connect with 23, and number 2 will connect to, you know, 947, that part doesn't matter. As long as they connect to somebody, and then we can, like, rewiring things. Yeah, I can figure out, well, okay, I've got this wire and this wire and this wire. Who are these others? And then gradually the brain will kind of figure it out and say, okay, well, this one works out and that one doesn't. So if you, when Sperry did a project in like the 40s, he took an optic nerve and rotated it 180 degrees. So this optic nerve is running this way. And he takes it, and he cuts it, and he simply switches it. And so now it's going the wrong direction. Optic nerve going the wrong way begins to turn and grow back the way that it was originally done. Because it's something in this chemical gradient says, no, I'm supposed to be going this way. You don't understand. I'm headed here. So now you've got this little turn, but now going the correct way. And that's how this works, is we have these chemical gradients that attract the axons by some chemicals and repel others. Yeah, it's one of the higher level ones. So the protein that we're looking at is the TOPDV. It's a protein that is 30 times more concentrated, for example, in the dorsal retina than in the ventral retina. So a neuron that is attracted to it chemically will head toward it and head away from it if it's not attracted to it. So highest concentrations connect to neurons that have the highest concentrations, and the lowest concentration axons connect to the ones that have the lowest concentrations of it. So all of this really is neural Darwinism, right? Where synapses appear randomly, they form randomly, but through this gradient guidance and the nootropic factors, basically some live and some die, and the ones that live get connected, and the ones that die off. So when we are born, we've got way more neurons than we need. And the reason that children are so plastic able to change to almost anything is because they haven't differentiated yet. And they're still all sitting there, all connected with each other, going, we don't know what to do yet. That's okay, but we're all still, you know, if they could talk, that's what they would do, right? They'd just hang around. But gradually, we get better at making those connections. And so these neurotropic factors are part of it as well. So there is a neurotropic or neural growth hormone that impacts the release of this, you know, of these kind of survival. If you don't have enough NGF, then axons begin to degenerate and die. And if you have more of it or extra of it, then you're going to get lots more things built. Right. Yeah.
Also connected to neuropruning?
Yes. And connected to drug abuse. So every time we get one of these neural growth hormone factors or neurotropics, it means that we're going to have more synapses with things around us. So there is one that is neurotropin, which is very similar to neural growth hormone. It promotes survival activity of a particular thing, right? This is there's a brain one. So there's a brain-derived neurotropic factor as well, BDNF. And this is a neurotropin in the cortex that makes little synapses grow. So when you have in your nucleus accumbens, you get, we talked about the drugs impacting the brain. You have stimuli in this portion now that are drug-related. And things that were, so the little neurons are growing, right? And they have a lot of neurons that are responding to stimuli that is drug-related, the drug itself, where the drug is located, how you got the drug, the anticipation of the drug, the people that you are with, all the other location cues that you have all produce a reaction because you now have lots of little neurons that have grown in order to respond to this. So one of the reasons that you can get sober but still be screwed up is that it takes the brain a while to adjust, and in fact, you never get rid of it. Once you're on cocaine or meth for a substantial period of time, the brain can't readjust. It always has these little neurons who will fire when they get a reward that is similar to the reward that they got when you were on a drug. So any cue that you got that was related to, this is at least a partial explanation of why you can be sober for a long time and then not be sober, right? Because those cues that you have are still, you begin to think that you're kind of immune to the stimuli. Oh, I can hang out with those friends again. And then you can't because and it's too late because the stimuli are all tied to that reward. But that's a growth factor as well, where the neurons are just, you've made a lot of synaptic connections. And you would think that making good synaptic connections is like a positive thing. And all it really means is yes, but it's simply saying that your brain is now more able to do this task, that this stimuli is now more important because we have made a lot of things that respond to that stimuli. That makes sense? Okay. So this plasticity part is just really growth of neurons and axons and dendrites, and then just a lot of them. Cortical differentiation just means that we have different parts of the cortex going to develop into different shapes and different functions and going to respond to the input as needed. So we're going to get some, as we mentioned, if you transplant something early on, a cell will become like its neighbors, but if you transplant it later, it's going to keep some of its old attributes because it's not as easy to change, right? So there's a point at which we differentiate and can't. So neuroplasticity, as it's called, is not something that is always available. You can't go back you know, at some point you've differentiated beyond plasticity. And as you age, you still have a lot of neuroplasticity, but not as much. So you're losing brain cells, you're becoming more efficient, using your brain, your whole brain more in different ways, but you still have lots of things that people can do. So essentially, learning, experience is what fine-tunes the brain. We can redesign our brain to fit whatever we're doing within some limits. Right? So if you take up a hobby, you will get better at that hobby, and your brain will be devoting more resources to whatever it is that you're focused on. So if you spend your time, you want to learn basket weaving. I don't know why you'd want to, but if you want to, you will then have more neurons devoted to that, and you'll begin thinking about things and looking at baskets differently, and every time you see a basket, you're going to interpret. That's a lot of brain activity, all focused on that same thing. So enriched environments, do they help? Well, sort of, kind of, maybe. In terms of unenriched environments, if you deprive people of stimuli, like children or animals, then yes, that there is a lot of bad things that happen if you're deprived, you have a deprived environment. An enriched environment, meaning you have lots of, if you're a rat, you have lots of toys to play with, or a child, have lots of toys to play with, you actually get a thicker cortex, and there's more dendritic branching, but it is the enrichment is more activity based. So just because you're rich enough to afford a lot of toys for your kids, doesn't mean that they are going to be as enriched as somebody who is poorer but spends more time with their kids. Does that make sense? So if you're doing things with them, then you're going to be building lots of neuron because of the activity, as opposed if you just give them a lot of toys and then send them off on their own. That's not quite as enriched. So you can't just buy your way through to good brain growth. When we talked about far transfer and near transfer being in learning, it's a far transfer is if you do well in one thing, you won't necessarily do well in another. Near transfer, if they're similar to each other, if you practice one task, you'll do better in it. But in general, you can't train the brain. You hear a lot of the things, well, we need to train the brain. It doesn't work. It doesn't work because, first, most people want to train the brain globally in this far transfer model. We'll teach you, Locke had this idea, we'll teach you mathematics and classics, which means that the things written in Greek by Greeks, and you'll have a trained brain, and then wherever you go, a trained mind, and you'll be able to do anything. And that doesn't work, right? It doesn't help you with your tap dancing. You have to have more skills than it. And then even to just show how specialized we are, there is no general talent for balance. If you practice balancing, you've seen those people on a ladder, I mean, just a regular ladder, and they're balancing on, they're very good at that task. If you put them on something else that they haven't experienced before, that they haven't had, done, does even about a ball, they're not as good. They're back to normal as everybody else. People who are surfers and snowboarders, like snowboarders?
Yeah.
Try and get the syllables in the right order. If you practice both, there's some similarities between them. But if you do one, and if you've never seen the other, you start off at about the same level as everybody else. There's no general ability for things like balance. Yeah, Arbaz? So the components that they share are the same. So if you're doing music, music and language are also highly similar, so that if you're Eastern European speaking, Eastern European music, which is different from different rhythms than ours, those will match. Your language and your music match. Western European music and language match in terms of the timing of things. So every culture has language patterns and music patterns, and they follow the same timings. So there's similarities there. Math and music match in the same way because they're same ratios, same pattern. If you have a tonic chord, it doesn't matter what key it's in. The relationship of the tonic to the dominant and the subdominant are just the same, right? You move your hands and you say, okay, this is the tonic, and now what's that fingering? Oh yeah, and I do that over here, and now it's the same thing in a different key. So those parts relate in general, right? And those, but you know, if you practice playing in, E minor, that's all you play in, you're transferring to B flat takes some adjustment. You still have to practice it, even though there's a lot of relationships that are similar. You're doing similar things, right? There's still a lot of running. It's not the same as, so basketball has the most constant running, right? Of all the things you can do. I don't like basketball. Or soccer, if you're going, so basketball and soccer, I think, would transfer similarly, aside from shooting. Although there's more head injuries in soccer, so stay away from soccer. Play basketball, all you can do is hurt yourself running. But you're not going to have the traumatic brain injuries that you're going to get from the other. So people think that soccer, you hit it. Oh, I used the bone in my head. There's no bone there. There's a ridge, but there's no bone. And so you're still making your brain shake as if you got hit by, it's football. Get used to it, right? Whether you tackle people or you soccer them, it still causes brain injury. Keep your elbows to yourself. Everyone knows that. All right, so if you are blind from birth, you are better at discriminating objects by touch. Yeah. Because you have more practice at doing that. Increased activation of the occipital lobe for touch, because it's not doing anything. It's just sitting there waiting to do something. And you say, hey, how about, if you can talk to your brain, how about using some over here? And so the brain just adjusts somewhat. Yeah, so more of the occipital lobe is used for touch than sort of taking the parietal lobe and sort of expanding it downward and using part of the occipital lobe for it. You use the occipital lobe for, if you're blind, for braille, where sighted people don't do that. Now, there's some problems if you are born without any vision at all. Your concept of straight lines are screwed up. You have no idea what a straight line looks like. They use vision more, but most people use vision a lot. Not as much change, but because of the temporal lobe shifts somewhat in terms of using the extra space for memory and relationships, but not for, it's not as much. There's no good thing that you can get better at if you're deaf. It's not a compensation one, like touch is. Mm-hmm. Yes. Your ability to use it gets better.
Right.
Yeah. But that's not surprising. Right, because it would just be, you're certainly practicing it more. So, not sure we have, how much we've shifted, we just know that it's there. Yeah. So if you learn to read it as an adult rather than as a child, you'll have more gray matter in the cortex and a thicker corpus callosum because you'll have spent more time transferring things back and forth to make sure they're on the right side, the proper side to be able to handle them. So there's some neuroplasticity in a lot of things. Professional musicians have temporal lobes that are about 30% bigger and connections in the front part of the corpus callosum that are increased.
Does it make them smarter individuals or just the better ability to play?
No, it just means that you're devoting your, remember the part of the temporal lobe has to do with sound, right? So we're spending more time dealing with sound, so you may be twice as good at responding to pure tones in the auditory cortex because you have a bigger area devoted to pure tones. And say, well, this is what that tone sounds like.
What about sound engineers, man?
Same thing. Also, people whose language, we talked about, whose language is tonal. So if you are born with a multi-tone language, you are much better at tones. Duh. Yeah, because you have all that practice. Yes, particularly Cantonese, because of the five tones. Mandarin, you don't only get three tones, but all that helps. Any of those things work. All right. That's our overview. All right, see you next time.